Welcome, everyone. Good morning. This is 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Welcome to Apropos of Something, airing every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. As always, we're grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Today, we are very lucky we have here Laura Jones. Jones is an activist photographer from Toronto for the UVA panel, Eyes and Ears on Economic Activism, that was held yesterday. It is part of a nationwide 50-year anniversary of the Poor People's Campaign of 1968, which led up to the Resurrection City of 1968. In that march on Washington, 3,000 people stayed on the mall for 6 weeks, demanding economic and human rights for poor Americans of diverse backgrounds. Jones photographed that time in history, and her work has been featured in numerous publications. She founded the Baldwin Street Gallery of Photography in a neighborhood that was home to Canada's exile community, Vietnam War resistors seeking refuge. We'll explore the Poor People's Campaign, her life and her work, and her continued activism today in Canada. And we are also extremely honored to have with us the esteemed Richard Guy Wilson, Guggenheim Fellow and Commonwealth Professor of Architectural History at the University of Virginia. Wilson is an eminent scholar of architecture, specializing in the design and art of the 18th to the 21st century, both in America and abroad. He's written, co-written, or contributed to over 24 books, not only about buildings, but he bridges architecture to art and literature. Wilson is, of course, also a teacher. Out of admiration for Wilson, an alumnus endowed the Richard Guy Wilson Prize for Excellence in the Study of Buildings, Landscapes, and Places. The UVA website says about Wilson that he has had a major impact on countless students through his knowledge, teaching, mentorship, and his wit. There's so much to say about Richard Guy Wilson. I'll save it a little bit for later when we talk to him a little bit later in the program. We are also going to talk about the Don't Want to Forget his exhibit at the Fralin, From the Grounds Up, Thomas Jefferson's Architecture and Design. It can be seen through April 29th. And you can check out all our past shows, just as great as this one, on the station website. You'll see interviews of more than 80 guests and 40 shows. We've covered fascism in Turkey, Poland, Germany, and lots of other stuff. Artists, we've talked about race with professors, historians, activists, and citizens. That's on 947WPVC.org website. Nancy, are you still with us? Are you there?
I am here. I've been wondering about poor Professor Wilson and what he thinks of the confines at the Charlottesville studio. I wonder if it inspires his next book, and of course I already know that that's not happening. Plates and coffee table grandeur in store for the place he's sitting. We have to apologize to him. I'm sure this is like way down on his confines.
Right. Anyway. Wait, what did he say? He's chiming in. What did you say?
Very interesting.
Okay, we'll talk about it later. I didn't
Nancy, always the diplomat. This is, you know, this is why you have that career. anyway.
Yeah.
Let's hope he doesn't exit the interview thinking, well, they were very interesting. Otherwise, we're totally back.
Right. Well, you know, in the spirit of the Olympics, North and South Korea marched into the opening ceremony together yesterday. And only one put on a 1,000-troop military parade, and it wasn't. We're next.
Can you imagine if? And it wasn't what? Sorry.
No, we're next. I said.
I know. Yeah, I was thinking. Thank goodness. Whenever we're due for another Olympics, thank goodness he's not going to be president. I don't even want to think about what thumbprint they would put on wherever ours would be. You know, this whole military parade that, of course, you know, we're getting it. It's not, no one's going to stop it.
Right. And did you know that North Korea has this department? Okay, this is real. The Propaganda and Agitation Department, which in the United States is just called the Republican Party.
Yeah.
That was.
I know. Yeah, I know. We got it. Well, we got it. Unfortunately, you know, there's little we can, like I'm telling you, you know, little we can do until November. Although there wasn't really, you know, we get these little hot spots, like the Democrats won a seat in a House seat in Missouri over.
Yes.
I think it was this week. There's
yes.
so much crap that goes on, but I think that was actually this week that one of them actually won.
Yeah,
31-point
right.
swing, amazing.
Yes. And I think also like a Trump territory again, of course, which
yeah,
is great.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. If only we could just advance the calendar. I mean, really.
I know.
I know we can't.
You know, I know a little bit less of what's been going on this week because last week I was in New York City and I saw you, which is fantastic.
True, in the New York office.
In the New York studio.
Yeah.
Yeah, the remote satellite that we have. And
yeah.
It also happened to be our show's one-year anniversary.
I know. And so what do you do on a one-year anniversary? You totally, we both, I don't mean you. I mean, what you do is you don't have a show.
Right.
I know.
You take it off.
We went on our one-year anniversary because yeah. that's the way we do it.
Right. I mean, I know what I did. I saw you. I saw a lot of friends. I saw Hello, Dolly with Bernadette Peters.
Hello.
I know.
Goodness, a big Broadway show. What was that like?
It was amazing. I think my expectations were low because I was walking down the street with a friend and suddenly another friend called and said, hey, you want to go? And we were like, yeah. So we were way in the nosebleed section. And I do think something's lost with the choreography when you're that high, because at some point, the crowd went wild and we were just all up in the nosebleeds going, what? What was that? Like, I think some of the moves were really structured for the people on the floor, but it was fantastic.
Yeah,
you know, all the shows,
the music carried, right? If not the
if
not the choreography.
And she came out on stage, Bernadette Peters, and before uttering a word, everyone stood up, standing ovation. That was fun.
Yeah,
yeah. And
good for you, man. Yeah, what else?
I don't know where to go because I have like about 2 seconds to tell you. I also saw the reenactment of a Bette Midler 1971 bathhouse performance, word for word, song for song, in the East Village. Very, very campy. Very good.
Now, that sounds pretty good as well, actually.
Yeah, it was.
So it beats the Big Apple tour on the double-decker bus. So,
it helps to have lived there and have really good...
So I tried to get you to ride that, and you said, no, I'm kidding.
No, anyway. We had a good time. I had a bad bagel, though. It's like, that's a first, I think. Anyway, this is...
It's bothering me still. I know no one else out there cares, but it's still bothering me.
So there's a movie thing going on in town here. I'm changing the subject. It's called I'm Not a Racist, Am I? It screened, I think, a few years ago, but it came back yesterday. And I think it's going to be screening in a lot of places around. So you can also go today at 1:30 to City Space and... there'll be an unpacking institutional racism kind of discussion about the film with the filmmakers. So you can email them at admin@pointmade.com to hear about other screenings and if you want to attend that.
Wow, that sounds really cool. I have one that is a companion, but not exactly. February 12th on Monday marks the 50th anniversary of the sanitation workers' strike in Memphis. Ooh. And across the country, fast food cooks and cashiers are all going to walk off their jobs in cities nationwide and
cool.
support higher wages. It's called the Fight for $15 for wages and for union rights. It's speaking of Laura Jones. It's bringing awareness to the new Poor People's Campaign.
Yeah, fantastic. So, with no further ado, let's talk to Laura Jones. Laura is here from Toronto, Canada. She's an activist, photographer. She's an activist and photographer here from Toronto. She was here for the UVA panel, Eyes and Ears on Economic Activism, held yesterday. Again, it was part of a nationwide 50-year anniversary of the Poor People's Campaign of 68. 3,000 people stayed on the mall for 6 weeks, demanding economic and human rights for poor Americans of diverse backgrounds. Jones' work was featured last year in Photo Ed. They published a 10-page feature article written by her called 10 Women in Canadian Photo History Everyone Should Know About. She founded Baldwin Street Gallery of Photography, a neighborhood that was home to Canada's exile community, Vietnam War resistors seeking refuge, of which I believe she was one when she went there with her husband. Welcome to the program, Laura.
Thank you.
So Martin Luther King had said a year before that march on Washington and before he was killed, he said, "I think it's necessary for us to realize that we moved from the era of civil rights to the era of human rights, and that we've moved into an era where we are called upon to raise certain basic questions about the whole society." So from your perspective, you lived through that. I'd love to hear, we would both love to hear your perspective. What's the difference between now and then? What's similar, and have we really gotten anywhere?
Well, I'll respond to the beginning first of what you said. And also, I'm always learning new things, and I did not know about the response to the anniversary of the Memphis sanitation workers' strike. And I am thrilled that that's happening. It's so important to recognize what went on in the past and to build on that. And the combination of issues, for instance, for Martin Luther King to take on the war in Vietnam, it was something that many organizations were opposed to. Many of the churches who had supported Martin Luther King were very cautious when he started talking in such extreme terms, and bringing in the issue of Vietnam was one that was very questionable. But it was an issue that I supported, and it was the combination of the civil rights movement and the peace movement that really drew me back to the Poor People's Campaign. There were draft card burnings, and in my photographs, it is women who are burning the draft cards. They are doing that because draft cards were sent to the Poor People's Campaign from all over the country. And so there wasn't one individual male who was going to represent all of them. They decided that women would participate and would burn the draft cards that were sent to the Poor People's Campaign. And I, when Martin Luther King was assassinated, decided that I wanted to be in Washington. I had already immigrated to Canada. I was working for an organization called the Company of Young Canadians, which was actually quite a radical group, but it was arm's length from the federal government. And it was social change was part of the mandate of the Company of Young Canadians. And what I was doing was organizing the surrounding community to where most of the draft dodgers were living, but we were working on education issues, housing issues. We stopped a 18-story transformer station being built on our block where all the houses were going to be turned down, and they were turned into housing that the city owned. And it was social housing. So I've been involved in lots and lots of issues, but I left that project, the Company of Young Canadians, to go to the Poor People's Campaign because I thought that it was just a very crucial event. And because there were riots going on across the city, I just felt that I needed to be a witness, a participant to that process. And I was also wanted to document it with my photographs.
And Laura, what circumstances led you to move to Canada as full time, you know, as a resident?
I was attending a Quaker school on Long Island. It was called Friends World Institute, and met John Phillips, who became my husband. But all of the men and much of the focus of the school at that time was trying to get what was called conscientious objector status to spend 2 years in a non-military capacity. And John applied to that, and he was turned down. His draft board was in Iowa. Our lawyer was in Philadelphia. Our school was in New York. At the time, my mother was living in Washington, D.C. So we were sort of spread out visiting different people and getting support. But the draft board made it very clear that no matter what John's religious support was, he was not going to get alternative service. They said things like, your father, who died when you were young, would not have liked that decision. We owe it to your father to make a man out of you and send you to Vietnam. So there was much of that attitude that they had, that they were absolutely not going to allow him to do alternative service. He had hoped, actually, to go to Vietnam as a photographer. And one of his very close friends did go, not as alternative service, but just simply went to Vietnam and was a photographer and became quite well known as a war photographer. So John's life might have been extremely different if he had been given the alternative service. But we did decide to go to Canada. John had gone through quite a few appeal processes, and it was actually the Ladies' Home Journal that took us to Canada. I give complete credit to the Ladies' Home Journal. Because while John was out at his final appeal at the draft board, I was sitting in John's mother's home in Iowa, Algona, Iowa, and was reading the Ladies' Home Journal. And there was an article about draft dodgers in Canada, and it had an address of where to go in Toronto for support. And so when John came back, he was devastated because he actually thought that he would either get a student deferment and be able to stay in school or the conscientious objector status. But I had the Ladies' Home Journal and suggested that maybe that since they said that they were giving him 30 days and wanted to send him to Vietnam, that we should at least go to Canada and look at it. And so we did. And we had 30 days, so we first went to North Carolina to say goodbye to the Quaker boarding school that I had been to and loved. And then we went to Washington, D.C. and said goodbye to my mother. And we ended up staying in Canada, and we got jobs quite quickly. Ironically, it was the Company of Young Canadians, and there was some concern about hiring people who were not Canadian. But we were hired, and that's really how we ended up in Canada. And one more thing, a photograph that I took of John when he first arrived in Canada was used by Wikipedia to talk about draft dodgers, and it ended up winning one of their little contests where the photograph matches the article.
Oh, nice. So can you tell us what the Poor People's Campaign was all about? I know there were some, it's quite elaborate. There are phases, and Martin Luther King was really the leader of that movement.
Martin Luther King was the leader. The original idea had come from Marion Wright, and she talked to Bobby Kennedy about that idea, and he was supportive. And then Marion spoke to Martin Luther King, and they decided that was a good idea to bring the poor people to Washington. Now, Marion arranged for Bobby Kennedy to go to the South, to Mississippi and Alabama, and meet poor people. And so it was a real eye-opening experience to him, and was part of the encouragement that people had to see the poor, meet the poor. And the issues were very wide. Stop spending money in Vietnam, putting more money at home. Many of the issues were economic, for jobs, for a guaranteed annual income. But it brought in many groups. So the Native people who were involved were concerned with Native land claims. And Latinos, there were just so many issues in so many different groups. They called them caravans from different parts of the city.
We're going to go to a hard break right now, but I'm going to love to talk about more about that with you. We're talking to Laura Jones, activist, photographer. She's talking about right now the Poor People's Campaign of 1968, and we're going to talk more about that when we come back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I'm Ellen Daniels. My co-host is Nancy Lawrence. We're speaking today with Laura Jones. A little bit later, we're going to talk with Richard Guy Wilson. So, Laura, we were talking in detail about the Poor People's Campaign of 68. Do you want to continue about the diversity and all of that?
We have more issues today that we weren't including in the Poor People's Campaign in terms of gay, lesbian, trans issues, any of those issues. They were in the background, but they were not discussed at all openly. The confusion of the diverse backgrounds led to less support. So the white middle class that could easily see that blacks had the right to vote without any blockages in that process, housing, the right to housing, those rights seemed to be more acceptable. But when you got into talking about welfare, then, for one thing, I think a lot of people didn't understand that there were issues such as if there was a man in the house, then the woman couldn't get welfare. So it put men supporting their children in a very difficult position, because if they really were desperate and needed the support, the men would have to leave or, you know, live in some kind of hidden way to be attached to the family. So there were lots of issues that made the system unfair. But it became a feeling of, you know, I pulled myself out of poverty, you know, maybe there, and everyone else should be able to do the same thing. So there was less empathy or understanding or even knowledge of the issues.
So there were phases to the campaign, and one was a shanty town. Another phase was public demonstrations and nonviolence. Can you talk about any of that? Were you there? I mean, you were there. What was your experience?
Well, there was a lot of chaos. I mean, the buildings were built in the first few weeks before the campaign got underway. There was a permit from the Parks Department. But much wasn't ready. More people came than were expected. There were different groups of people who would decide to go off on their own and block traffic or have a spontaneous demonstration. There was a huge demonstration on Solidarity Day, which was toward the end. About 50,000 people came, but that was less than some of the mass demonstrations in the past, particularly the 1963 civil rights demonstration that people tend to compare to. There were people who were lobbying Congress. And the shantytown was there the entire 6 weeks. And one of the complexities was the rain, that it rained so much that it was muddy, it was uncomfortable. The diverse groups had much to work out, because there's such a big difference between a ghetto black and a rural Appalachian person who'd lived on a farm. They had not lived in a city. Many people who came to the Poor People's Campaign had not left their county where they had lived. And then they find themselves at the Poor People's Campaign. There was food, there was daycare, there were many programs, but they were all a little bit in flux in terms of the quality, so that there were barrels that were sort of old barrels that people were sometimes cooking over. And yet, well, it was just a very difficult time. But people came with a considerable amount of hope, but they were depressed from the start with Martin Luther King being assassinated. And then to have Robert Kennedy assassinated was just was just devastating as well. His hearse was actually taken to Resurrection City, and people were silent and were moved. And it's hard to function and to organize when you have, you know, a dozen of issues, and the issues are changing as new groups arrive and as people change their strategies. And I think that it was really thought of as an absolute disaster, because it ended the civil rights movement. It expanded it into a completely different movement, which was an economic-based movement.
You're talking about the assassinations, or what killed it?
The concept of the Poor People's Campaign itself, by combining all those issues, took...
I see.
The death toll to the civil rights movement in terms of it being a movement unto itself with clear issues.
Mm-hmm. And
Laura, you photographed so much during that period, and I wanted to know if it was the period that brought out your camera, or if you were a photographer by nature.
I was already a photographer, because in Toronto, we had January 1st, 1968, we had started the Baldwin Street Gallery of Photography. And so photography was part of all of the projects that we were doing. My husband, John Phillips, was actually in Newfoundland working with the Challenge for Change program with a film program during the time of the Poor People's Campaign. And so... the program that I was running in Toronto had to do with children with learning disabilities, teaching them photography and to write their own stories about their lives. We had one family with 14 kids, and extremely poor families who were part of our program, and we were working really with the entire family, as well as the emphasis on photography with children. So when I went to the Poor People's Campaign, I already was interested in photography. And I had friends, and Chuck Fager, who wrote a book about the Poor People's Campaign, they were already in Washington. And my mother was in Washington. So I had this... I felt I could be nowhere else. That was where I wanted to be, and I brought my camera with me.
Were you allowed access back? And once you moved to Canada, I'm just curious, could you come to the United States whenever you chose to?
At the beginning, I could come back, because at that point, you didn't even need a passport to go between Canada and the U.S. All you needed was just a piece of identification. So there was no problem initially going back. For kind of a complex extra story, my passport was revoked, and there were... And as well as my husband's passport and citizenship. So my citizenship was unclear because they had given me no reason to take mine away. So at that point, I did stop going back because I didn't have a clear ability as to whether I was going to have a problem or not. Mm-hmm. And I was stopped by immigration once at the Poor People's Campaign, and that's a very unusual thing to do. But Steve Raitt, who borrowed John Phillips's car because John was in Newfoundland, was driving the car that had been in Saturday Evening Post, a picture crossing the border. And so American immigration actually stopped the car because they thought that John was in it. And I was arrested, actually, at the end. And I was told that I was going to be kept in the state of Virginia until my husband came back and got me.
Wow.
So there were things that went on that are still confusing in terms of what really happened, or who was making these statements and whether they had any authority at all to make them. But because I didn't know whether anyone who was making these kinds of statements had the authority or not, I took it seriously. When I went to become a Canadian, and that wasn't until the 1990s, it wasn't clear whether what had happened with my American citizenship. There didn't seem to be any record when we tried to look it up. So that was difficult, and I had actually wanted to run for city council and couldn't because I hadn't been a citizen. And the first time that after I got my citizenship, I ran for school trustee the very next day, and I won. And I won against people who had parties and offices, and we didn't even own a car or have anyone on my committee who owned a car, but we won. So the first time I ever voted in my life, I voted for myself.
That's a great way.
Think about the voting thing. Goodness. Yikes.
That's a great way to close. I know you need to be somewhere, and we're so glad that you came all the way from Canada.
Thank you.
Yes, thanks for being here, yeah. Laura Jones, activist and photographer. Thank you.
Yeah, you were everywhere. Your photographs are outstanding. It was really nice of you to spend some time with us this morning. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. So we have a news of note. Nancy, do you have one?
I do have one. It paints a lousy picture.
I know. Why am I not surprised?
Anyway, from the White House, that is still vilifying the less fortunate, I bring more of that news, which is that after already allowing states to impose work requirements for Medicaid enrollees, this administration is now pondering lifetime limits on adult access to coverage. So they're thinking of capping health care benefits, which would be a first for Medicaid. It would be a policy change which would recast, you know, government subsidized health coverage as temporary assistance by placing a limit on the number of months adults can access these benefits. And it's, of course, unfair. It would shave valuable coverage from people that need it, ironically, to work. And as well, you know, for people that work in low wage jobs that don't have insurance from their businesses. So it's next on their punching down list.
You know, it was so great just not to pay attention for a while, and I think that's why I've been in a much better mood. It's just, it takes a toll. But thanks for noticing what's going on, letting me know. Well, just in relation to Laura Jones, what she was saying, since 68, this isn't a new thing, but I just wanted to mention the number of Americans below official poverty line is increased by 60%, and the top 1% share of national income has nearly doubled since 68, while the official poverty rate for all U.S. families has merely inched up and down. You know, so it just ties into the damage they're still trying to do. But I wanted to ask you if you've heard of Cheddar Man.
I have.
Okay.
And But I forget. I have, but I sound like I haven't because I can't.
Okay.
I have.
So what it is, about a century ago, a fossil was discovered of a guy in Cheddar Gorge, England. And they thought, right. And so they called him Cheddar Man. And they thought he had fair hair, light eyes. But it turns out new DNA research shows that he had dark, you know, he had brown to black skin and dark, dark curly hair. So it just goes to show, you know,
yes,
people migrated.
Through,
right. You know. We don't all look the certain way just because we come from a certain place.
All right. Yes. No, that's a good one. I forgot. Yes. Sorry.
Okay.
Yes. That's a good one, Alan.
Yes. So our next guest, he's been very patiently waiting. His name is Richard Guy Wilson. We're very honored to have him here. He's a Guggenheim Fellow, Commonwealth Professor of Architectural History at the University of Virginia. He's an eminent scholar of architecture, specializing in the design and art of the 18th to 21st century, both here and abroad. He's a teacher, and out of admiration for Wilson, an alumnus endowed the Richard Guy Wilson Prize for Excellence in the Study of Buildings, Landscapes, and Places. The first award was presented in 2017, and he had a major impact on countless students, UVA says, through his knowledge, teaching, mentorship, and his wit, which we may hear a little bit of today. He's written, co-written, or contributed to over 24 books, not only about buildings, but bridging art and literature. A sample of his book topics illustrates his range of knowledge from Newport shingle style, the Prairie School in Iowa, to Edith Wharton's life and home, and a book on the machine age, highlighting American art, architecture, photography, film, and industrial and graphic design in the years between the two world wars. And, of course, there's the architecture of Virginia and the University of Virginia, which brings us to Wilson's most recent endeavor, I believe, a new exhibit at the Framlin Museum here in Charlottesville called From the Grounds Up, Thomas Jefferson's Architecture and Design, and it can be seen through April 29th. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yes.
I'm glad to be here.
Good. Well, do you want to start out with something since
yeah.
you're, I mean, we have a lot of questions, but I feel like you know so much more than we do. Is there anything you want to tell us in particular?
About
the Framlin, yeah. About and Jefferson's vision and what do you think he was trying to do or and why did you decide to curate that?
Well, Jefferson is, as we all know, a very complex individual with many interests, many contributions, both positive and that sometimes could be viewed as negative. Authored the Declaration of Independence, third president, Louisiana Purchase, an intellectual, also a slave owner. But one of the things that was one of his greatest passions, and there are a number of quotes can be on this, but my favorite delight is putting up and pulling down. Architecture is my delight. Was that he did design not just his own house at Monticello, or his second house at Poplar Forest down outside of Lynchburg, Virginia, but the University of Virginia, he designed that. Many other houses, courthouses in the area, very involved in Washington, D.C., in the architecture and the laying out of that, while he was Secretary of State in Washington's first administration. And then he designed the Virginia State Capitol down in Richmond, which maybe, well, I would say it is the most important building because it is the first public building built after the Revolution. And the choice of the style there was a Roman temple based on a temple in the south of France, and it set in motion an identification of American public architecture with the classicism of Rome and later on of Greece, which persisted for at least a century and a half, and in some ways is still, I think, to many people, a big classical portico is an image of American public architecture. And so he really started that with the Virginia State Capitol down in Richmond.
So we're going to go to a break, but we'll be right back. Don't go away. We're talking with Richard Guy Wilson, Guggenheim Fellow, Professor of Architectural History at the University of Virginia. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Apropos of Something. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I'm Ellen Daniels. My co-host is Nancy Lawrence. We are with Richard Guy Wilson. Hey, Nancy.
Yes. Oh, definitely. Professor Wilson, I was wondering, in terms of his vision, before you go back to Virginia, what were his plans? How did he see D.C. and the Capitol? What did he want us to be, you know?
One of his major concerns, and indeed the concern, I would say, of the other, quote, founding fathers, was that we needed to establish an identity in this brand-new, young republic, not even a population of 4 million at the time, and something that could be on the stage with what was going on in Europe. And so it was very, very much, Washington, D.C. was a brand-new city. Initially, the United States Capitol was in Philadelphia, and it did move around a couple of different places, Annapolis, Maryland, etc. But the idea was that they were going to establish a new town. Washington picked the site there. The laying out of it was done by a Frenchman by the name of Pierre-Charles Lafont, who was a friend of Jefferson. Indeed, Jefferson loaned him a tremendous set of maps that Lafont used to help develop his plan for Washington, D.C., but there is an early sketch that Jefferson did for Washington, D.C. that in embryo sort of sets up what today we see as the Mall in Washington. And then there is simply the public architecture, and that, well, if we're going to be a great country, then we've got to have great architecture. And so the consequence is that you got the United States Capitol, which has been modified many different times, to the building today that we know as the White House, which was the Executive Mansion or the President's House, and then other buildings after that.
So there's a lot of European architecture that's influencing him, but I was wondering, how did he feel about anything homegrown, you know, local? Did he?
Jefferson wrote only one published book called Notes in the State of Virginia, but it does deal with a larger picture than just Virginia. And he bemoans the state of architecture in this country. He says that the genius of architecture has spread its maledictions over this land. He goes on and condemns practically every building. Williamsburg, the Capitol down there, the College of William and Mary, which he attended, the governor's house, he said that, but they had roofs, they've been mistaken for brick kilns. In other words, there was absolutely nothing that was here. And that was one of his, I would say, major accomplishments. One of his goals was to reform American architecture.
So we can skip around a little bit. We can come back to Jefferson, but I was really fascinated by the book that I saw you wrote about Edith Wharton at home, Life at the Mount. And her home is in the Berkshires in Lenox, Massachusetts. I believe she designed it. You can straighten that up. That's not true. She bought 116 acres, and you write about how it affected her as a writer. Can you talk about her and her life and what drew you to that?
Well, Edith Wharton's first published book was The Decoration of Houses, co-written with a young architect by the name of Ogden Codman Jr. However, it is Edith who really wrote most of the book. I've done endless research on the thing, and she is the person that wrote it. There are certainly Ogden's ideas in it. The book, when it was published by Scribner's in 1897, they only accepted it because they thought she might have, she'd only published a couple of poems and one or two short stories, she might have some prospects as a writer. And so they accepted it, and unbelievably, the thing was a bestseller. It was actually published 2 years later in England, if you can believe that. The English would look at an American book on architecture and taste. It was a very, very influential book. And if you do read Edith very carefully, I think, architecture, interiors play a major role in her fiction, and indeed you can say that she is a product of a sort of a psychology at that point in time, that we are created by our surroundings. In other words, it isn't just some sort of, divine coming down from above, but we are a product of our environment, and so the architecture, the surroundings are very important, and this is a constant theme that runs through all of her work.
And speaking of, people inspired by the surroundings, Poplar Forest. What was Jefferson's intent on with that one?
Jefferson's house at Poplar Forest, just outside of Lynchburg, was a getaway house from the chaos that had developed up at Monticello. Because at that point in time, anybody could come up and knock on the door, I want to see you. I mean, the way that we have the segregation today of protection and so forth just simply didn't exist. And it was just simply chaos up there because he was such a famous individual. So he created Poplar Forest, and he also created as his ideal home. And so in geometry and so forth, it's an octagon. In the center, there is a perfect cube, which is the dining room. And these perfect shapes were something that was very, very conscious in idea of intellectuals at that point in time. And so that's what Poplar Forest was, is really the ideal, the getaway.
Mm-hmm. And aside from that, what else is in the exhibit at Fraylin right now that from the ground up, what can people expect to see there?
Well, we have a section that goes into a little bit of the design world that Jefferson knew. As I already described, the very poor architecture was here. Then what he did see abroad, he spent 5 years, 1784 to 1789, principally in Paris, but also traveling rather extensively throughout Europe. And also the other thing that he did see that was really something possible in this country was nature. And so that is in there. And then there are the houses, Poplar Forest, Brimo, Monticello, of course. Also, how these things were built. We have a section on construction and fragments of buildings and the nails that were made up at Monticello. And then, of course, the University of Virginia, which we can say is his greatest work. But then we have a section on the public buildings and the Reformation of American taste.
In your own life, speaking of environment being so important, I don't know if you can share some of that or if you wouldn't mind. What you probably travel quite a bit. I know some of where you've been. How does it affect you, and what do you like to see in your environment, and what do you have to say about that from a personal point of view?
Well, I'll look at practically anything. I look at the grand architecture. I am also, though, a roadside freak. I like to look and see what is going on along the roadside. Diners, American diners in particular, are something that I am passionate about. The older types of diners from the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. But I'll look at you name it. I'm willing to look at it and incorporate it.
Do you have something you're working on now? I mean, maybe is that a forthcoming book?
Well, I have a book underway on Monticello, but then I've got to get out of Jefferson. I've been doing quite a bit of Jefferson, and that's
fine,
but I do want to move on to other things, and I am working on a book on mid-century American modern, and in particular the suburbs that were developed, modernist suburbs that were developed across the country, and people that accepted this new architecture in those years.
So what is your approach to designing a space, Jefferson aside?
Well, my approach to designing a space is that first you got to figure out what it is intended for, and of course it might have multiple uses, but that it should have, you've got to figure out what your purpose with it is. Secondly, that you do want your furniture to be comfortable, but not too comfortable, that you fall asleep at your computer. But also that I do think that what hangs on the walls is very important. My wife and myself are avid art collectors and have collected all sorts of different art from leading American modernists to outsider art, folk art, and also photography.
I have to say that I visited your home once for different reasons. I know your wife as well. It's wall to ceiling. It's ceiling to floor art. It is fantastic, so much so that I brought an art history friend of mine over when she visited here with your permission. It's fantastic.
Well,
yes. What's one of your favorite paintings or pieces of work in your house?
Whichever one I'm looking at that point in time.
Wow.
No, I mean, I'm varied. I don't collect. I just acquire. But, I mean, it depends on what it is. Photographs, in particular, there is sort of maybe a tendency towards buildings and photographs. But at the same time, say the outsider art, something that in particular has sort of emerged. We've had folk art for a while, but the idea of outsider art, something emerged in sort of the 80s, the 90s, and is, I think, very important going on today.
Mm-hmm. And outsider art meaning people who didn't get a formal education?
Is right. That what people you mean? That don't have formal education, and in particular, in many cases, they are coming from the poverty side of the tracks and using very strange types of materials in the creation of their art.
Mm-hmm. And is there a reason, not that there is, that your study of architecture is more in the 18th to 20th century, but obviously your art and even exhibits you've curated are more contemporary? I'm just curious. They don't overlap that much necessarily, and is there a reason?
Well, I think what you're driving at is that I've been doing so much Jefferson, and that's the problem, that you get to the University of Virginia and you get caught into the Jefferson mafia here. But at the same time, I'm sorry if I'm offensive there.
Not at all. I was worried for you, that's all.
But at the same time, I mean, it is clear that he is one of the most important figures that really did stride across the American architectural stage. One of the persons, the other great American architects who I've done a little bit on, the guy with the three names, Frank Lloyd Wright. But Frank Lloyd Wright once said to a group of his students, this is recorded, that if Thomas Jefferson were alive today, he'd be sitting at the head of the table. And I think that, I mean, they're very different tastes, mm-hmm. but still at the same time, it is that impact.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of teaching, before we run out of time, did you always want to teach architecture? You're obviously very, students love you, so did you always want to teach?
Oh, it's just something I sort of discovered as I went along. I mean, I had a varied career because I couldn't figure out what I wanted to do after undergraduate school. Tried law school. Thank goodness that didn't work very well. And moved on into the U.S. Navy. And then I love books, and so into library science. And then, oh, my goodness, well, maybe you can do something with history of architecture. So
unfortunately, we have to say adieu. But I want to hear the one place. It could be Frank Lloyd Wright piece of art, architecture or a painting, something that you would recommend someone to go to, like a bucket list kind of thing, or a couple things that they should see visually. It doesn't even have to be architecture.
Things that people ought to see. You ought to go to the Grand Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you ought to go to the Big Valley at Yosemite. This is one of the things that is particularly, I think, very important about America is our nature. But then from an architectural point of view, yes, Frank Lloyd Wright's Falling Water. But alternatively, the lawn at the University of Virginia, I would say. Also, the mall in Washington, D.C. is one of the great public spaces in this country that has been used politically, so for many different sorts of points of view, but I'd say is something that is there. And then, well, go and look at one of those giant skyscrapers.
Yes. Some of them are pretty.
And something else I'd like to see is you back here to continue the conversation. We'd love to have you back someday.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Thanks for your time. Thank you for being here.
Yes, indeed.
Nancy.
More than interesting, right? Yeah. Yes,
you know
I know we're
ready.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. The palate cleanser. What do you have?
All right, what I have is Let the Games Begin, Ellen, as we were speaking of a little earlier. But today is really the first day of medal competition, and the U.S. Olympic Alpine Ski Team, first medal events. We got the men's downhill tonight and the women's giant slalom tomorrow. And two of the men have been in four Olympics. One of the guys has won two already. You got Lindsey Vonn. You got Michaela Schifrin. I mean,
fantastic.
We're all got our hardware ready. We're going to dominate.
I love your optimism.
The Norwegians.
Yeah.
Anyway,
so,
anyway, what do you got?
Well, apparently there was a lost Mayan home to 10 million people that was uncovered in the jungles of Guatemala. I mean, some of these things I talk about, I'm not sure they're true. I never hear about them after I talk. No, it's totally true. It's considered a major breakthrough. There were... Oh, do you know about this? Are you talking... Oh, Richard, do you know
sure.
about this?
Or yes, there you
about
go.
The discovery
the
of... Yes, the Mayan
please.
Ruins. Yes, no, it's...
There you go.
It sounds like it is just amazing, the extent, the size of this, which they hadn't known for years, covered over with jungle.
Right.
And it's, well... It's a lot.
Yes. So 60,000 houses, causeways, elevated highways, man-made structures. They belong to an ancient Mayan empire, supposedly home to 10 million people.
Yes.
That
yes.
is
Whoa.
Crazy. Yeah. And they found it using something called LIDAR, light yeah. detection and ranging, I guess, lasers yeah. or technology.
Yeah. No, it's just covered totally with overgrowth, and they've been able to discover this thing
Amazing.
There.
Amazing. I'd love to go see that.
So after the Grand Canyon, this place.
Right.
Something like
right,
that.
Right, right.
Okay, all right.
So, Nance, how you Hi. Doing over there?
That's true. Your palate cleanser is obviously so worthy that even Richard Guy Wilson knew about it, and I'm just
I know. That, I'm so glad that really gives
Very impressive.
It gives a validity for sure. I'm so, yeah.
For sure.
I'm going there for our next anniversary.
That would be pretty, that, yeah.
So thanks, everyone. Thanks for listening.
At first.
Yeah. Thanks for listening, everybody. Thanks to the Beckham team at Keller Williams. Also, remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. We'll see you next week. Bye, Nance.
Definitely. Bye.